now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we'll reflect on sensational Scotland's win over Spain and just what it means for Steve Clarke, their manager. We'll also reflect on Rodri's comments that they're rubbish. Wales make a solid start to qualifying as well as life after Gareth Bale goes as smoothly as possible. Also, there's big news at Spurs as Fabio Paratici, their director of football, is banned worldwide. But what does that mean for their plans moving forward? And we'll look ahead to some big games coming up in the Premier League this season as Roy Hodgson returns to Crystal Palace and Manchester City take on Liverpool. This is The Game. Hello and welcome back to The Game Podcast with myself, Hugh Wisencroft, Gregor Robertson, Tom Roddy in the studio with me, Jonathan Northcroft from his palatial palace to discuss, let's be honest, the result of what? The last couple of decades, last few decades for Scotland, first of all, of course, because, well, firstly, just a massive step in terms of wanting to qualify for the European Championships. Big win over group favourite Spain. Fantastic atmosphere, fantastic result. Their first competitive victory over Spain for 39 years. They are now top of Group A after the first two matches. The victory over Cyprus and then the win over Spain, humbling them. They are now 5 points above Norway in the group, 3 points above Spain. It is pretty much the perfect start to qualification. Jonathan Northcroft, how pleased were you with this victory and what was key to it?
I was just revelling in your introduction there, Hugh. I nearly poured myself another dram while you were humbling Spain. How pleased was that? I'm still smiling, to be honest. And it was an absolutely brilliant result. But the best thing about it almost was it wasn't entirely a surprise. And that's a real testament to where we are now under Steve Clarke. It's only 4 years ago we were losing to Kazakhstan. That major tournaments just seemed like, you know, so far away. And under Steve, we've now got a proper football team again that you can rely on to perform. And the reason I thought we had a really decent chance of winning was the record, albeit there was that Ukraine loss that under different circumstances that cost us World Cup qualification. But if you take that aside, Scotland have become a team that wins the games that they should. Got to be honest, that Spanish side is about as poor as a Spain as I've seen. And looking at them on paper before the game, I thought we can beat these because we've got a good team, we've got good players, and we're playing at Hampden. But the way it was executed was fantastic. Yeah, Scott McTominay takes the honours. I don't know how he's or where it's come from, but that ability to arrive in the box and score goals it's just clicked with him, following on from his performance against Cyprus. Two brilliant goals, but there were great performances across the pitch. Andy Robertson was as good as I've seen him. Kieran Tierney for the second goal. I thought the centre-halves, particularly Ryan Porteous, were really good. Callum McGregor, you can always rely on him. And in goal, Angus Gunn looked like he'd been playing international football for a long time. It was just a brilliant night. It was just an absolutely brilliant night. Made all the better by Rodri's tears afterwards.
We'll come to those. And the pressure on the Spain squad and their manager, Luis de la Fuente, as well. Already people questioning how he got the job as manager. So in terms of qualification, you know, a managerial change at Spain, uproar in their media, that's absolutely the perfect recipe for Scotland topping this group, coupled, of course, with their own positive performances. Great from Steve Clarke as well, just generally, in terms of the home record in particular with Scotland and the ability to win matches there at Hampden Park has been important.
Yeah, I think it's two defeats in 18 competitive games. And even actually, there's Michael Grant's piece, there was a good juxtaposition between his first game was against Cyprus, and there were 31,000 people there 4 years ago, and it was a sellout for this against the same opposition, you know, and it's a sellout for the rest of the year. So, like, that's a big change. That's a big change in the atmosphere and the whole environment and the whole, like, expectation levels and enjoyment. Well, wanting to be there, wanting to go and watch your nation play. And this is why you see the kind of, you see the commitment. You know that we're going to, you know, Spain were going to have more passes and dominate the ball and possibly have more chances, although they didn't have more clear-cut chances. But you saw the commitment and you saw a threat and the kind of unity. That's the kind of, that's the biggest thing. And I don't know how he's done it. I honestly don't. I don't know. He did it at Kilmarnock. I remember going up to Kilmarnock and writing a journeyman column about, but then when they were flirting with reaching Europe, which was, you know, he took over when they were in the relegation zone. He has something. He has something that's kind of means he can make a team that's greater than the sum of its parts, basically. And there are also tactical elements to the way he sets up in terms of settling upon a back three, making the most out of having your two best players as left backs, basically, and that, and actually still getting something in the attacking sense from Kieran Tierney, and also bringing people in like Lyndon Dykes, and who we said before, he's not necessarily going to score the goals, but he'll help other people score the goals, and he gave Spain's defence an absolute runaround, like and bruising night. I echo what Johnny says though. Watching this, I thought this is not Spain. Like, they were swinging crosses into the box all the time, and they got a few decent contacts in the first half, but it didn't look like a Spain team, and we deserved the win.
Yeah, of course. 75% possession for Spain, but they weren't really going anywhere. Just on Lyndon Dykes, got to say, I was surprised by his performance, having watched him at Queen's Park Rangers. You know, I know he's been injured and he had pneumonia, and but to play like he played off the back of being out and not have had it, having had a great season, I thought he played particularly well on the evening, could have had a goal as well, and leading the line, you know, that has been an issue for Scotland. I would say that I do think the quality in this squad, international squads generally, do you need a lot to be good at international football? I was reflecting on the World Cup, the number of teams that were just, they had a plan, they worked hard, they were together, they had that spirit, and how difficult they made it for the perceived higher quality opposition in international football. And I kind of said, if you had a squad of players who were kind of all in the top six in the championship, say, that level of quality, you could still have a pretty solid international team. Now, if you add to that, I think Scotland have, you know, pretty much half a team of Premier League players now, and then a couple of excellent players, the two that you mentioned, Kieran Tierney and Andrew Robertson, in particular, leadership as captain, that can lift you, I think, elevate you to, you know, the status that you've got at the moment. I'm not going to say you're going to win the Euros or the World Cup or anything like that, but to be a very competitive side at this level is what Scotland are. And I think, you know, as good as Steve Clarke is, I think you do need to sit back and say, you know, McGinn, very good player. You know, Che Adams, okay, a Premier League player. Stuart Armstrong hasn't always been in the squad, or Scott McTominay, who was on the bench in the first game. You know, for me, Callum McGregor is a very good player. I know he plays in Scotland, but, you know, I've always thought he was a very talented player, and he looks very comfortable at this
level. Composure at the end when he kind of dipped away from, was it Gavi came on?
Yeah.
And sent through, it could have been Dykes, I can't remember. But it's, yeah, just little moments of composure he has in midfield are brilliant. We're under pressure. And McGinn, we've kind of skirted over McGinn. He's like a leader on and off the pitch. And you've mentioned the word leadership there. There's a lot of them now. And I think Andy Roberts actually said that in his interview afterwards. It's not just the captain, it's Tierney. Hanley's been in the squad a long time, although, like, people always look at it and think, is there someone who could take his place? He's actually performing really well now for Scotland. McGregor's a leader. He's, you know, captain for Celtic. I think McTominay could become one of them guys. Ryan Christie always steps up. There's players actually who play better. You mentioned Lyndon Dykes there. They're playing better for the country than they do for their clubs. That's always a good sign.
Doesn't part of that come from the fact, you mentioned them being leaders, Gregor, that they've been together for quite some time now, these players, this group of players. And the curious thing is, Johnny referenced Kazakhstan 4 years ago. You know, it wasn't so long ago that things weren't so great, to put it politely, but it feels like there is, like, a lot of nations, it feels like international football is a bit of a relief, a bit of a respite for some of these players, and it feels like that's similar with Scotland. Would that be fair?
I think it does. I mean, Michael makes a really good point in his piece today about how Steve Clarke's almost turned the fact there's no superstars in the squad into an advantage. You know, Michael says the advantage of having a team that there's no irreplaceable player means that you can become a collective. So you take someone out of that Scotland squad, that Scotland team, put someone else in, and it survives, and it's fine. And as you say, Tom, it's getting that sort of environment where for these players, it's like another club. Turning up there is a pleasure. It's being part of something that's bigger than the whole, and that nobody's bigger than anyone else. And I've said this before in the pod, but Steve Clarke reminds me so much of Craig Brown, who was a Scotland manager when I started out and was taking us to Euros and to World Cups. And I mean, Stephen, I think, learned under Craig Brown. That they've talked about each other a lot. Craig was maybe slightly more upbeat character, but similar sort of good old common sense, but with a real tactical shrewdness. And what Craig did, similar squad, no real brilliant players, but lots of very good players. He made Scotland into a club. That's, he always talked about Club Scotland, as it were. And it's got a very similar feel. And in the same way that you could rely on Craig's teams to shoot par or better than par in games, I think you can rely on Steve's teams to do the same. And that is the environment that he's created.
If you like football and rugby union, it's a good time to be a Scotland fan. I got to say, two very good teams. I'm enjoying watching both of them at this point in time. Rodri isn't, and I think he's reflecting, by the way, more on the football side than the rugby side, because they are very enjoyable to watch. But Rodri, Manchester City midfielder, Spain midfielder, saying after the game, it's the way they play. But for me, it's rubbish. Always wasting time, provoking you. Always they fall. For me, this is not football. Incredible, really. Lack of self-awareness, by the way, for a Spain midfielder to say that. But also, given poor results that Spain have had of late against the likes of Morocco at the World Cup, Japan as well, now Scotland. And by the way, they beat Norway 3-0 in their opening match. And I've got to say, for a 20-minute period there, this was an Erling Haaland-less Norway without him because of a groin injury. They were knocking down the door. There were a couple of fantastic saves from Kepa in that game. And in the end, they scored two goals in 3 minutes to basically make it look comfortable. But Spain weren't comfortable. They're not in a great place at the moment. I find it very strange that Rodri said that. But you guys, or maybe Tom Roddy, how do we reflect on whether he's right or not? Are Scotland S-houses, you know, as much as we praise them, is this part of what makes them good?
But yeah, partly, but I also think it's important not to focus. And this isn't just Rodri, this was Spain as a whole. I mean, David Garcia said the grass at Hampden was too long. And maybe it was, but I mean, it certainly wasn't too long. But the excuses are, it's a bitterness that comes from playing that type of football week in, week out. And in international football, you have to play to your strengths. And I don't think Scotland are S-houses, as you put it, Hugh, but you have to play to your strengths. And, you know, with Wales, with Kiefer Moore up front, they will play to their strengths there. And I think it suits Scotland, it works for Scotland. And it wasn't like the percentage of possession was overwhelming, but it wasn't like the game overall was mismatched at all.
I was actually surprised when I saw the possession stats. I thought, it can't be that. I didn't feel like Spain were dominating Scotland, like they couldn't get out their own half. Like it didn't feel like they were chasing the ball around for the whole game. I was actually surprised by it. I'm not saying I didn't think Spain had more possession, but it didn't feel like a 75-25 game, to be perfectly
honest.
Football's
about being effective, and Scotland were the more effective side.
Yeah, it was very rare that the kind of final pass was something that cut through Scotland. It was often just across into the box. And as I said, there were a few moments in the first half when Joselu in particular got on the end of things. But once that was rectified, they didn't really have a major threat. And look, Scotland were clearly sent out with a little bit of advice to try and, you know, rile them up a bit, leave one on them if the opportunity arises. Andy Robertson was only too willing to take that on board, I think. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was remarkable. Like it was hilarious. The idea of a Spain midfielder saying that about Scotland players. What a world we're living in. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah. But also, it takes away from the tactical approach of Steve Clarke as well, because Spain love to get the ball to the byline and cross it in the same way that Man City do, that those typical goals. And the setup of Scotland's defence blocked those opportunities constantly. So it wasn't. It reduces the praise that Scotland deserve.
Ultimately, you make eight changes, you know, Spain or not, you're going away from home to Scotland. I mean, it's like you hadn't done any research. You know, a side that is so strong at home, and you decide to put essentially a second string team out because you didn't choose it for your opening game, which you won 3-0, which we saw the kind of perceived bigger names named in that lineup. Why on earth he decided to make those changes to go to Scotland, I've got no idea, but I'm glad he paid for it. To be perfectly honest, Luis de la Fuente, because it was a poor decision. Only second competitive game in charge. He will learn, shall we say. But yeah, very good from Scotland. Eshauser isn't a national tradition, just to be clear, that they haven't been, you know, I'm just
not
asking.
Not lucky enough,
yeah, that's true. You came through the system, so it's not an instruction or anything like that for young players.
No, but I'd love to see it being that in the future.
That's it. Gregor Robertson needs to be involved for Scottish football for this reason, OK? Like Tom Roddy says, those are the fine margins, and you've got to do what you've got to do, and that's maybe part of Scotland's game. Anyway, an excellent victory for them, as I say, beating Spain competitively for the first time in 39 years. I know you mentioned them very briefly there. I just wanted to say something about Wales. They had a pretty good start to qualifying. They got 4 points from the opening two games. Their second was a win over Latvia. Finished 1-0 thanks to Kiefer Moore's header. Puts them top of their group, Group D, after their 1-1 draw, that win at the death against Croatia that we mentioned. Nathan Broadhead getting the goal. Before the game at the Cardiff City Stadium, we saw the man. I love him now more in retirement, I think, than I did as a player. Gareth Bale, you can kind of sit back, you know, and, you know, have those memories on his fine career. But he was out there on the pitch and gave his thanks to those loyal fans in the Red Wall. He got a guard of honour as well and said goodbye to the home supporters. It was emotional. I kind of listened to him speak and thought, shouldn't you be on the coaching staff? Or like, shouldn't we be inviting Gareth Bale into
I'm sure he's been asked.
Into the Wales fold already, yeah, probably to be chief executive, to be honest. But given the
El Presidente,
exactly. Given the injury issues that Wales had, they've had some retirements, obviously Gareth Bale and some other very experienced players. The World Cup for me was a bit of a shambles. I think we all saw that as well. I think they'll be very happy, Rob Page's side, with their start to qualification, solid start to life after Gareth Bale. And to be perfectly honest, for me personally, this is a team that is maybe freed up by Gareth Bale's absence, because obviously having such a talent but such an effective talent for virtually all of his time at Wales, even if he wasn't doing it in club football, he was still doing it for his country. You had to gravitate towards him in terms of your style of play. Now we might see some of the younger players come out of the shadow a little bit, the likes of Brennan Johnson. Maybe we'll see a better all-round team performance from Wales moving forward. They had, I think, something similar, you know, 75-odd percent possession against Latvia, 15 shots, only scored once, towering Kiefer Moore header, as I say, and maybe that is the area that they now need to work on, because, as I say, their forward line, their attacking line, kind of revolved around getting the ball to Bale, or at least getting an opportunity for him to have a shot on goal, and now it's going to be more about the team, which I think is a positive.
Yeah, it filters into what we were just talking about with Scotland. There is not... Now there cannot be that reliance on one player, looking to one player to be the solution to all their problems. And it's quite entertaining that the first camp back without Bale is still about Bale, yeah. because he is what they're missing. But I don't think, you know, during the World Cup, Rob Page used a false nine system sometimes, and again that was all around Bale a bit more. He didn't utilize Kiefer Moore in the way that we maybe expected to him as often. So we will probably see that a little bit more. But again, I think there's a trend in international football where you've got Steve Clarke, Rob Page, Gareth Southgate. They all have this almost gentle hand, and as Johnny referred to earlier, it's about creating this environment. And I think Wales have it too. Players going there, Rob Page referred to wiping off the cobwebs of players. A lot of them aren't playing week in, week out in their club football. They go to these international camps and look forward to them now.
I think it was a positive start for Wales. And things can click a little bit more. They didn't have all of their attacking players. I mentioned Johnson didn't start either of the games, of course. But the likes of Harry Wilson, again, that all-round quality. Aaron Ramsey looked very assured this time around as Wales captain, of course, playing a little bit more for Nice at the moment and looking in better nick too. So I think it was, as I say, a positive start. You know, a draw with Croatia in a game that you really didn't deserve to get anything out of, and then a 1-0 win at home. I think they will take it, something to build on. So, yeah, that's the international window wrapped up for us on the game podcast. Of course, all about Scotland's fantastic win. England weren't bad either, but you expect that. There you go. Anyway, we're going to move to club football next on the game podcast. Spurs making all the headlines once again. Stay with us.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, we mentioned Spurs on the last episode of the game podcast at length, of course. The departure of Antonio Conte, massive. What is next for the club is huge. All of those questions are up in the air, but maybe the question marks have got a little bit larger because a little over, 12, 13 hours after Fabio Paratici had put out a video, Spurs had put out a video of him basically saying, here's what the future's going to be, managerial search, players, etc. Well, the managing director of football is probably going to have to step away from his role because FIFA have extended his ban, which was given in Italy, worldwide. He was given a 13-month ban in January after his former club, Juventus, were found guilty of false accounting. You know, Juventus were given a points deduction in Serie A. He was their sporting director and managing director before joining Spurs in June of 2021. Paratici and Juventus have both appealed against the decision. Spurs are asking for further information. That's the last we knew, which really they should have got already, to be perfectly honest, once they saw that this ban was probably going to be extended worldwide. But it does leave their plans, and it's an important time, obviously, for the role that Paratici has in terms of helping to choose a new manager after Conte's departure, and obviously not far away from a summer transfer window. In my heart of hearts, I almost think, is it a blessing in disguise? He hasn't pulled up any trees. Conte's left. He was kind of seen as an appointment that was there to support Antonio Conte, let's be honest, given their previous working relationship. So for me, to have them both out of the club at the same time, clean slate, maybe a new plan for Spurs might not be the worst thing in the world. What do you think, Tom Ruddy?
I'm not sure about blessing in disguise. I think Conte's departure could be seen as a mistake by the club, but it was an ambitious appointment. It wasn't the right fit because Conte's expectations are so high. He's a demanding guy, and you can kind of sell it as he wasn't up to it. His heart wasn't entirely in it for once. But this is a totally different story because Paratici was brought in to really take them to the next level, and actually, I think he is an extension of Spurs' managerial policy in that they, in recent years, because they've been hiring guys like Mourinho and Conte, who they want to take them to the next level. They're hiring coaches who have managed at clubs who they want to be. And Paratici was a little bit of that as well. Juventus, even in Daniel Levy's statement when he first hired him, he spoke about the fact he has an outstanding track record in assembling competitive squads and the high level of success that he had at Juventus. I never really got the impression that Paratici felt that he needed Spurs as much as Spurs needed him. And it hasn't, and that's actually a similar with Conte as well, which isn't the relationship you want to have with anyone at a football club. I don't think that Spurs have totally been in this kind of rinse-repeat cycle, because they did look at getting Graham Potter. But I think they need a manager. They need people who are going to take them on the journey, up-and-coming managers, up-and-coming coaches. And I just think the Paratici situation is chaotic, really.
Jonathan Northcroft, what are your thoughts on what's going on at Spurs? Any chance that they can turn this, spin this into a positive?
No, and we've seen how poor their efforts at spin have been over the last 48 hours. Even if Paratici hadn't been then sanctioned by FIFA, the video they put out, him in his front room mumbling only semi-coherently about the future and the amazing fans, to try and dampen the kind of heat around Conte's departure. Even before the FIFA sanction, that was a poor bit of communication, I felt. They are in a real crisis. I think a rival paper today has mentioned it as being the worst of Levy's reign. It certainly feels like the worst in the last sort of decade of it. I mean, the first decade of the reign was pretty chaotic. But, I mean, I was on here a couple of weeks ago, and I must admit, I got it wrong about Spurs. I remember speaking to Hugh just after the FA Cup defeat to Sheffield United and saying then, look, you know, it's not as bad as it seems. They're still in the Champions League. They're still in a good position in the top four. They'll be all right. And I still had a faith that Conte was going to belatedly pull things round, and that was wrong. You know, that was wrong. He just didn't, at the end of the day, invest enough of himself, I think, in the project. He seemed to decide quite early that he wasn't getting exactly what he wanted, and therefore it wasn't him to blame, and his energies went elsewhere. And I think that's spread throughout the team. I think there's Tom's right about Paratici, quite similar. It felt like he's passing through as well with Spurs. It has felt like the most committed people at the club have been the players, that Harry Kane's commitment, let's say, hasn't been matched by managers and those on top. And let's be fair, Daniel Levy, I don't think his commitment's in question either. You know, for all his criticism, I do think he's put his heart and soul into making Spurs work, but he's got it wrong. And one of the ways in which he's got it wrong is he's thought that the shortcut to success is to invest your money in a manager, and maybe you can then skimp on what you're paying in terms of the squad. And he's hired, as a consequence, Jose Mourinho, now Conte, two of the most expensive managers in world football, two of the most winning managers in world football, but maybe without investing comparable sums in the squad, and thought that maybe putting those two together might give you that shortcut to success. But all that's happened is those two managers I've mentioned have felt that Tottenham haven't fitted their profile, haven't fitted the squad, hasn't fitted their sort of status as managers, and they've complained about it, and I think they've devalued the project, if you want to call it that. They've helped create a discontent around Spurs, which, you know, makes them ever more less attractive to players coming in, I think, and seeps into the fan base. And has created that sort of disconnect. And there has to be a big rethink in the summer. If Paratici goes, which it looks like he will, that is at least an opportunity to start again. But it does feel like, again, Spurs are looking to build from a low base, while rivals, you know, not least Arsenal, forge ahead. I'd be pretty depressed if I was a Spurs fan at the moment.
No, I tend to agree with that. Greg, I'll show you.
I think the Paratici thing is that they've clearly been blindsided. Absolutely. You know, I think there were 15 hours passed between that video, that grainy video, which was pretty kind of amateur, and the announcement that it was a worldwide ban. So they clearly were absolutely, like, came out of the blue for them.
They shouldn't have been, though, because well, it was January that the Italian FA requested that it became a worldwide ban. So it wasn't necessarily an announcement. It was confirming.
But then there's a conversation about what action could they have taken then? There's still a due process to be concluded. And the only argument is I actually believe that the investigation began before he was appointed by Spurs. Four months before he was appointed by Spurs. So this is clearly it should have been known by Levy and Spurs. And that, I'm sure it was, and if it wasn't, then clearly due diligence wasn't taken. So from that point on, I don't see what they could have done differently, because there are some people and some other journalists and whatnot saying that he should have been sacked. You've got to let the process be completed, and I think now it's clear he's probably going to have to go because he can't do his job. But even then, I'm not a lawyer, but I think it'd be an interesting question to see if there's anything in his contract about. Is this malpractice? Has he done something that will breach his contract? I don't know. It's probably going to cost him a lot of money.
He wasn't working for Spurs.
Exactly. And it's not in the same jurisdiction even probably, although it probably will be now under FIFA. But look, there's a lot of questions there. So I think you can't necessarily see this.
And he's appealing it. So how long that takes, we don't know.
So while this is a crisis at Spurs, undoubtedly, for reasons, no manager, Harry Kane's future, there's other things that the fans are slightly uneasy about. There's still no name for the stadium. There's a talk of a big hike in season ticket prices in the summer.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not sure how they can possibly justify that just now. So there's clearly unease, but it's a crisis that needs to be put in context. Like, when you see their supporters' trust come out, I've seen this before, saying, we urgently seek answers about the direction of the club and stuff. I think, come on, guys. There are clubs that are in real crisis around the country. You're fourth in the Premier League or whatever you are. And there have been some really bad decisions in the last few years, but you're still, you've come a hell of a long way. And I know I completely agree with Johnny. I would be pretty kind of down if I was a Spurs fan just now, because Levy has made some... I said it on the podcast the other day. He's failed miserably in the last few years. Since Pochettino left, almost every major decision has been a failure. So the bigger question now is about his future.
Yeah.
That's my view, I think.
He's not going to go, is he? Joe Lewis is a businessman.
That's why I'd be most depressed then.
Well, Joe Lewis, the owner, is a businessman. He's an American. I don't think we're going to think that he knows football inside out. He's obviously bought a football club. Daniel Levy has helped to grow his business significantly. The value of that football club must be a huge change from the amount of money that he paid. And it's about what levels you think Spurs are at. Obviously, we've never seen them go out and spend the money of the Chelseas and the Man Cities and the Man Uniteds. So, given their budget, what is the best that they can do? And I think the fans, one of the reasons that the fans might be disappointed is, for me, this is the moment to sit down with the fans and say, what do you want your football club to be? And then go appoint the director of football, appoint the manager that suits what we all think, all of us in the Spurs family, the club should be. I'm not saying that you ask the fans who the manager should be, but Tottenham has a historical, I think, sense of a team that wants to play football. So that's your starting point. And if the fans are happy and are going to be happy just with that, then that's okay. That's a good starting point. Get the best football team. Get the best football.
They're never
going to
be happy with that, Hugh. Come on.
No, but I'm saying
they want to win things. Okay, they want to win silverware.
You're misunderstanding what I'm saying. Spurs fans not winning silverware is acceptable if you have a team that goes out there to try and play entertaining football, that tries to score goals. They're never going to be happy not winning trophies, I agree with you. But currently they have a team that doesn't win trophies, that plays defensive football and has appointed several managers in a row who play defensive football. So they're sitting there saying, well, look, you clearly don't understand the football club if you think these managers are right for the fans. That's my point. At least if you're appointing managers that want to play football, even if you're not winning trophies, the fans can say, well, we're trying to do it the way that we all want.
Hugh, I think you've put your finger on something, actually, which is Spurs have... It's this age-old tension between the business side and the football side that we've seen maybe in previous years, that era when Arsenal were kind of happy to be top four because Champions League got the money and they didn't have higher ambitions. The Glazers at United. I think there's a similarity with Spurs, because if you ask, has Daniel Levy done a good job? I think there's two answers to that. The business answer is he's done an amazing job. Mm. Spurs were worth £20 million when him and Joe Lewis bought into the club, and it was Daniel Levy that really led Joe Lewis into it. And they're now worth £2.5 billion. and they've got the best stadium in London, and they've got the best training ground in the country, and they generally have turned a profit on transfers and year after year. That's an incredible business feat that he's pulled off, but he hasn't got the football side right. And Gregor's right that in the last, certainly since Pochettino, the football decisions have been pretty much disastrous, you know, failure after failure. But is Joe Lewis ever going to be this unhappy with Daniel Levy? Probably not, because he's making him so much money. So what it then comes down to is Levy's got a responsibility to try and make the football project better, to make the football project work. And he's always talked about being a Spurs fan, and he's in it for more than just the business side. He's in it for the love. Well, he has to understand then the needs of those supporters, as you say, the desires that they have to play a certain type of football, and to get this football project to be a bit more successful. I think he's just miscalculated, as I said earlier, in thinking that if you got the right manager in, that would sort of kind of fix everything and be a shortcut. And we've seen enough about how football's moved on from football clubs that we're in a different era now. You have to get everything right. I think you have to get everything right now, from tactics to coaching to, it's a holistic thing now in football, and they haven't got there. They haven't been holistic since Pochettino.
Bringing this full circle and kind of following on from that, Johnny, actually Paratici, I remember hearing a theory right at the very beginning of Paratici being appointed, and it was almost like Levy had got to the point where he'd been criticised for making so many mistakes on the football side that he was handing that over to Paratici. I mean, not that he, you know, this is a bit Logan Roy succession. He wasn't going to be stepping back completely. I think he was going to be involved, but Paratici was going to be the face of it. He was going to be the guy that when Conte goes, he's doing the video from his home in Italy. He's going to be the one who picks the guy who's the interim in charge. It's Stellini this time instead of Ryan Mason. So I think that was part of what Paratici was meant to be. He was meant to be the guy who sorted out the problems, the football side of things, and let Levy control the commercial side and take credit for that. And his hope was that it would work on the football side with Paratici, and it just hasn't. And the problem is right now, you're thinking the mistake was appointing Paratici.
One thing I would say is in that video from Paratici, there was kind of a few comments about the quality of the youth players at Spurs. So I thought, it's international break. Let me have a quick look. In the under-19s squad this week, they played. They got a victory, but they haven't reached the Euros. England's under-19s haven't reached the Euros, which is pretty poor, to be perfectly honest. But ultimately, no Spurs players at all in the under-19 squad for England. I know it's only one nation. They've got plenty of players from other countries as well, so it's a very small litmus test. Under-21s, Oliver Skip, who plays a lot of games for the under-21s, Jed Spence on the bench. Skip was on the bench too. Usually he starts. They had a friendly, so... But
Gary Jacob wrote a piece about this earlier in the season, actually, kind of comparing the two clubs. That's another reason why there's, like, more of a sense of connection at Arsenal now in terms of a few... Well, a growing number of players have come through the academy, and you're now seeing them represented on the pitch. And really, there's not been many in recent years at all at Spurs. I think Tanganga had a period, but there are not many that jump to mind. And that's, you know, Spurs. That's something else. Spurs were kind of, there was a little period where they were known for, but it's not really been, despite the amazing new training ground, investment in that area, it's not really coming to fruition on the pitch. So,
given the catchment area of both where the training ground is and where the football stadium is, and the number of young kids, excellent young kids playing football in the capital, I just think it's an incredible shame that a top six club with a bit of investment in their academy are not producing regularly players that we would see are good enough, at least for the Premier League, if not for Spurs. So that is clearly one part of the football club that has been failing. And again, you know, if you can work that out, it can be a huge boost. All right, Harry Kane, one of our own, we get it. If you can produce one or two of those a decade, maybe not at his level, but certainly very good top-level players, that can be a huge boost to your football team. Even if you sell them for £100 million and they don't stay at your club, that is a huge boost. That academy has to do better. So whether it's under Fabio Paratici or someone else, that's another area at Spurs that needs to improve. I kind of looked at all of this news this week and thought, the main thing, I was like, this is really going to harm their chances in the summer window. Because I just don't see how a lot of top players are looking at Spurs right now and thinking, that's a place that I want to be. You're looking at a club and you think they've got no sense of direction. Unless they offer me a lot of money, I'm probably going to be wasting my time. I'm definitely not going to win anything. We're probably going to go through loads of managers, and you know, I get it. If it's a big step up for you, you're still going to want to play for Tottenham. But it's about trying to bring in players that improve Tottenham, and ultimately, the players that are at bigger clubs than Spurs are probably not going to want to move to them at this point in time because it just looks like they don't know what they're doing. So, well,
and as you mentioned, Hugh, earlier, the Harry Kane elephant in the room, that him potentially going with such a short amount on his contract left, and then replacing him. Attracting players to replace him. But me and Johnny were in Naples for the England-Italy game, and I've never seen Harry Kane look like that. He came into the press conference afterwards and he was so overjoyed by becoming England's all-time record scorer, which is partly his patriotism but partly this achievement. You know, he was at Wembley on Sunday holding that the shiniest trophy I've ever seen in my life. But it's just the achievement, and I think he will want to kick on from that. He will want to be holding more shiny things.
A couple of games for us to look ahead to this weekend in the Premier League. We're going to start at the bottom. We know there's a huge game at the top because it's Roy Hodgson's return to Crystal Palace. Of course, South London boy, they host Leicester, two teams in trouble in terms of the relegation fight. And really, the question is about what Hodgson, Johnny, will bring to this role between here and the end of the season. I don't think I've ever seen a manager with a more fortunate fixture list, even though Palace aren't playing well at the moment, to know that you have to play between here and the end of the season. Every team that is beneath you makes it probably the best running in the Premier League, even though Palace aren't playing well. So, listen, for me, I predict a positive little run here for Roy Hodgson. That being said, if it doesn't go well, it's critical for Palace.
It is. Look, I broadly agree with you because Palace are very clever when it comes to making managerial changes. I personally feel very sorry for Patrick Vieira and that he had done enough in his tenure to warrant more patience. But they felt it was critical, and we've seen in the past that they've been pretty shrewd at making changes at the right time to preserve their Premier League status. And as a short-term measure, I get it. As a short-term measure, I if you ask me, have they got a better chance of surviving with Roy in charge than they did with Vieira, I think the answer is yes, they do in the short term. Where I slightly disagree is I think Vieira would have kept them up anyway, and they could have perhaps done other things like refreshed the coaching squad, the coaching staff, and he could have tweaked himself. But leaving that aside, Roy brings experience. You asked what, that's the most obvious thing. Not just experience in relegation situations and his vast experience as manager, but experience of the squad and experience of managing the key players in it and getting the best out of them. It's not a brilliant squad in terms of it lacks a really good striker, but it's a pretty good squad apart from that, with some really, really talented players. And I think he will have enough. They will have enough. I think Leicester's a big opportunity for them because Leicester are a club that are really drifting and vulnerable at the moment. And it gives Roy the opportunity to grind something out, grind a result. And it's only one or two results would put Palace safe. That's the other thing. One or two would almost be enough.
I broadly agree, Johnny. His presence, I actually think, is going to be a huge change. I know Roy has the experience of doing this often, but I think his presence, because a lot of football is mentality, and I think many members of that squad would have seen the trend, the form at Palace, that horrible stat they kept hearing that they hadn't won this calendar year. And they'd have looked at Patrick Vieira and thought, are we okay here? Is this guy going to get us through? And I agree, Johnny, I think he would have done. I think it would have been absolutely fine. But now I think Hodgson comes in and they know the history there. And I think that will change the mentality. It will give them a confidence that looks like the new manager bounce, that horrible cliche that we always refer to. I think it will give them that. It's like a fatherly arm around the shoulder, Hodgson coming, or grandfatherly arm around the shoulder with Hodgson coming in. But Palace do have a trend of this, you know, the Pulis, Warnock, Pardew, Allardyce, Hodgson twice. They do tend to go for a safe pair of hands. And my only worry would be that before, when Hodgson came in, it was a case of trying to stop the goals going in. This time it's the opposite. Under Vieira, they were losing by one goal. It was fine. It was really fine margins. Now they need to start scoring goals, and that's not as easy for him to do.
Steve Parrish has got a good record in terms of his appointments. I think Warnock and De Boer are the only two that didn't work. But I find it bizarre. I find that, despite all the kind of just about agreeing with what you've both said there, I still find it absolutely bizarre that they've gone back to him after this whole new kind of blueprint of, you know, investing in youth, changing the kind of style of play. They've just taken a massive backward step. And I know it's purely kind of designed on Premier League survival and like the desperation to do so, but I still find it absolutely bizarre. And Hodgson was retired. He was retired. I was reading that as recently as March 9th, he was doing a dinner with Roy Hodgson at Craven Cottage, £200 a ticket. That was his world. Yeah. And now suddenly he's back in a Premier League dugout at 75 years old. It's insane.
He's got experience. I don't want to be ageist.
I'm not diminishing his talents. I'm not being ageist either. I'm saying that from Palace's point of view, it's a massive backward step. And I think slightly panicked as well.
Yeah.
And I think actually, Steve Parrish's kind of legacy is slightly on the line here, but, you know, because so much improvement. What is it, 10 consecutive years in the Premier League? It's an amazing new training ground. Generally speaking, in the last year or so, we've been speaking about Palace as this is brilliant.
It's
a club that manages in this global Premier League to retain something of its kind of local roots and its sort of community spirit and players who reflect the area almost. Like, that was all great things we were praising. And I'm not saying that's been lost, but it's under threat now. And there's also, I think, probably some unease behind the scenes in terms of the kind of four partners who own shares in the club and, you know, taking this decision, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
I think two of them were kind of flirting with buying Chelsea not so long ago, so their commitment is slightly under question. So it's a bit of a juncture, I think, for them. And if they go down, it's a disaster.
Yeah.
And a disaster for Parrish as well.
None of us want to think it, and we all like Roy Hodgson. He's had a great career, but obviously if he takes Crystal Palace down and the Watford
and
fans...
his legacy's...
Watford fans in particular were saying, whoa, are you sure he's still committed? Because they didn't see much from Roy Hodgson when he was their manager in his last job. I do think it's a huge one for Crystal Palace, a huge decision. Personally, you look at the two managers and you think they're going to get a similar number of points by the end of the season. I mean, we've been through it already, but I just don't think Palace were playing that badly. I get it, three games without a shot on target. Yeah, it looks bad for the headlines, etc., etc. They've had an incredibly difficult run. And ultimately, you know, under Vieira, we were praising them last season for having an attacking style. I get it, they haven't got a striker that scores goals, but given the fixtures that were coming up, they were going to win a few games. There was going to be enough there for Palace to stay up, take stock in the summer. And if you truly feel Vieira isn't the man for you, then you can make the decision then and try and get yourselves in, you know, the manager of the future. And Roy Hodgson just isn't that. I just find it to be very peculiar. But I do think they'll stay up. I think there's enough in that squad and Hodgson's experienced enough to see them do it. I'm not sure they'll beat Leicester at the weekend. I know, Johnny, you're saying they're a team who are maybe, you know, I think have big question marks over them themselves. But I do think there's much more attacking quality at Leicester, and I think it'll probably be the difference this weekend.
Yeah, look, Leicester, a funny one, and I did a piece last week where I was, among other things, trying to assess who would go down. I found Leicester the hardest to assess because on the one hand, they are in a terrible sort of, I wouldn't say free fall because that suggests they were at a great height with their performances and they haven't been, but they're really weak at the moment. Really, the club is flat. But on the other hand, Hugh, as you say, they've got James Maddison, they've got Harvey Barnes, they've got Kelechi Iheanacho, they've got Daka coming off the bench. they do have real quality at the top of the pitch. And in the end, I said I didn't think Leicester would go down. And the reason was I thought, look, it's quite simple. James Maddison will have enough good days between now and the end of the season that he'll see them all right. Leicester's issue is deeper, and it's what happens at the end of the season with this squad that's a lot of them going to move on, and people like Maddison are within the last year of their contract. I think they'll get to the end of the season just about okay, simply because of those really talented players. But they're weak. They're a nice team. They play nice football. Are they an ideal team for battle? I'm not sure. And that's why this game specifically is a good opportunity for Palace.
Before we talk about the games at the top of the table and the big one between Manchester City and Liverpool, very quickly, because there are another couple of key games at the bottom of the table, just wondered how you see them going. Big pressure on David Moyes if West Ham don't beat Southampton at home. I think that will be hitting the headlines at the weekend. So how do we see that one going? Do we think West Ham are going to have enough to beat Southampton, who have put in a couple of positive performances, Gregor?
God, it's hard to call. These are all so hard to call. It's going to be like this every week until the end of the season. It is, you know, I think we're doing a piece for the weekend that's like, this has got the makings of like an all-time great Premier League season.
Yeah,
it has, because there's so much still like up in the air.
Everything,
yeah. Absolutely, yeah. With so many clubs. So I can't answer that, to be honest.
I'd be shocked if West Ham, in front of their own fans, are beaten by Southampton. I would be shocked.
Nothing would shock me. Southampton have been buoyed a bit by Ruben Selles. So, and West Ham, they sometimes look, they kind of, with attritional football, get a result, and other times they just don't look like they're going to score. So, draw.
Okay.
On the fence, absolutely.
Okay. Wolves playing Forest this weekend, Tom Roddy.
Is it home or away for Forest?
Forest are at home, Tom.
Well, in that case, they're such a different side, home and away, Forest. They're dreadful on the road. I can't tell you why, but they're dreadful on the road. So they actually have a chance. But like Gregor said, every time I feel confident in a decision, in a prediction, which you know we love on this podcast, every time I feel confident in a prediction, it ends up flipping on its head and being totally wrong.
I'm just loving at the moment that there is no game of the weekend. Even if we feel like this weekend is the game of the weekend, it's hard to choose what games you're going to watch and what games you want to watch, because there is so much, as you mentioned, Gregor, going on at this point in time. You know, I think that will be a cracking match between Forest and Wolves.
I'm going to Brighton versus Brentford, which might go under the radar a bit, but there's two of the clubs that could, you know, gatecrash Europe, and, you know, the two that were seen as like the great disruptors, that's going to be a fascinating game as well.
Even Arsenal against Leeds, I think, is a tricky one for Arsenal, because Leeds, you just never know. They throw the kitchen sink at it. If the ball hits the back of the net a couple of times, it could be like that Bournemouth game. We could get a dramatic one, or else Arsenal might steamroller them. Like, you just don't know the way things are going at the moment. Maybe that's what makes the Premier League the greatest league in the world. Okay. Go on, Johnny.
Come on, though. It's Manchester City, Liverpool, though. I mean, I am going to that one. No, I mean, look, I really take your point, actually. Every fixture's got something on it, and it's absolutely brilliant this season. But City, Liverpool has just developed this edge to it that reminds you of the old United Arsenal rivalry, and I can't wait for that one.
It's even Manchester United against Newcastle this weekend. I mean, there are just some big, big games. But okay, Johnny, fair enough. You've brought us onto it. We might as well end the podcast with the small matter of Manchester City against Liverpool, Saturday lunchtime. We know exactly how things sit at the moment. City have a game in hand, do they? But Arsenal have an 8-point lead in the Premier League table at the moment. Is that right? Well, this is a chance, I think, for Liverpool to give their top four hopes a massive boost. We know the rivalry that's been between these two sides. I went to one of their games earlier on in the season, cup match, I think it was. And the fans don't like each other at the moment. Let's put it that way. So there'll be a pretty heated atmosphere as this one kicks off. And I think Liverpool will feel like in recent seasons they've been certainly the biggest bogey team, but almost had the number over Manchester City at times, even if they're not at their absolute best. So this weekend, will they put a dent in Manchester City's title hopes, and how do they do it? Jonathan, how do you see it going?
Well, first, Erling Haaland is the big imponderable. Is he going to play? He's had a groin injury. That would change a lot of things about this game. Liverpool are so hard to fathom at the moment, going from that 7-0 to the supine performance at Bournemouth. So they're another team. We've been talking about teams that are kind of hard to read. I think Liverpool are one of them. But it's going to have that sort of crackling intensity, that atmosphere, that energy around the game, which I actually think does bring the best out of Jurgen Klopp's side. That said, I can't see City not winning it just because they do seem to have slipped into that City mode where they've got a target and they're pursuing it vehemently and relentlessly. And I think it's going to be a brilliant game. City are slightly more open than they've been in previous years, and so are Liverpool, and I'm probably setting up for a 0-0, but I'm expecting a 3-2 or something like that.
Gregor?
Yeah, Haaland's a big one. Obviously, even then, you think we've got Alvarez who could come in. They could play, go back to something more akin to how they played last season without a recognised striker. Pep could dream up something else because it's only one of these big games where he often does that. Mm-hmm. I agree. I think City, like, it's so consequential for both of them and City mainly. And I think if they don't win it, then it's becoming increasingly hard to see them pulling back enough ground on Arsenal. So I think unless they win this, then it's almost impossible to see that. So I think that will kind of, that knowledge will get them over the line. I think they know that they have to win this game. And it, as Johnny says, it could be a really, really feisty one.
I kind of, and I've said this before on the podcast, I kind of hate the Premier League scheduling, because what they do is after the international break, they want to come back with a bang. They always want to do that. They want the Premier League to be the biggest talking points in world and European football. But, you know, for a Man City-Liverpool game, I want them, you know, to go in having been together, played a few games, go into it at top form, 100%. Obviously, players will have travelled from South America and all over the world in the last couple of days. And that, I think, affects the quality of the game that we'll see. And in my mind, I think that will affect Manchester City more because of their style of play and the fact that Liverpool are maybe a more chaotic style of football, maybe thrive at times on the counter-attack away from home as well with the speed that they've got. And maybe, look, I'll call it a more simplistic style of football, if you like, but it may help them in this game. Manchester City, you know, if they are full throttle, which I don't think they've been all season, but if they are going into this game, you probably make them bigger favourites at home than you do this weekend off the back of the international window. So I can definitely see Liverpool, and we say this, you know, you never know what Liverpool's going to show up. Well, ultimately, I don't think it has to be the best version of Liverpool to get a point this weekend against City. I think it could be a very tricky game for Pep Guardiola's side.
No, I agree. The focus will inevitably be on Man City because of the title race, and it seems ludicrous that with so few games to go, I still sit here and think that City...
I've been banging that drum all season, Tom.
I just can't believe that everyone's just like, yeah, City, don't worry, they'll go out, they'll win 7, 8, 9 games in a row.
I can see it.
We haven't seen it, though. We haven't seen it all season.
No, but it's this stage of the season. That's the thing I feel. It's this stage of the season where City have been there and done it. And we saw what happened with Arsenal last year, and actually it's worth pointing out Liverpool as well, because they will be a little bit of the subplot to this story, because it was all about the Premier League title race. But they've got City, then they've got Chelsea, then they've got Arsenal, so they're going to have a serious say in this title race themselves. But with that run of games, the context that their season ends, and the question marks over the summer are going to be huge. What they need to do in the summer, the reboot that they have to their squad. So I always feel like Liverpool are just teetering on the edge, and it is hugely unpredictable which way they're going to go each game.
Prediction?
City.
Oh, I'm surprised by that.
City, yep.
Yeah, City. Oh, 5-4 or something.
Yes. I'd absolutely love it, but I think personally I'm going to go for a 2-2 draw. We may have, and I'm going to warn you all now, given the quality of the fixtures this weekend, it could well be the longest episode of the Game Podcast ever on Monday, depending on the drama, the VAR, the goals and the results. All of that for us to discuss on Monday when we return. But Gregor Robertson, Tom Roddy, Jonathan Northcroft, thank you very much for being with me. And thank you all for listening. Remember, on every Monday, you want to check out the game. So either pick up a paper or, of course, download the Times app. You can also subscribe to the game online. It's thetimes.co.uk/the game. We will see you on Monday.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.